This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McGee. U.S. President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence visited vaccine development sites on Monday, marking the beginning of the largest COVID-19 vaccine research trial yet. Their trips to North Carolina and Florida respectively come as the White House grapples with its most prominent virus case since the crisis began and a nationwide spike in the outbreak that threatens to undermine an economic rebound. White House officials say a vaccine is necessary to fully restore a sense of normalcy. Thursday marks the 6 months since the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern. Reflecting on the millions of infections, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the pandemic continues to accelerate. He stressed that although the world has changed, the fundamental pillars of the response have not, which referred to political leadership and informing, engaging, and listening to communities, adding that they have the basic measures needed to suppress transmission and save lives hasn't changed. And that means leaders should find, isolate, test, and care for cases and trace and quarantine their contacts. Tedros also pointed out the pandemic was under control in many countries, including China, Canada, Germany, South Korea, because the countries strictly followed the WHO's advice. Incidentally, more than 652,000 deaths have now been recorded globally from COVID-19. That figure is more than 148,000 in the United States, and the number of global infections is more than 16.4 million and more than 4.2 million in the United States. Brazil ranks number 3 in the number of infections and deaths globally. This is VOA News. The United Nations says that coronavirus-linked hunger is leading to dozens of deaths, or I should say the deaths of tens of thousands of children a month in the first year of the global pandemic because of fears of contamination and movement restrictions. In a study published Monday, 4 UN agencies said failing to act now will have devastating long-term consequences not just for the children, but for society as a whole. Earlier in the year, the head of the World Food Program warned of a risk of starvation of biblical proportions around the world. From Burkina Faso to Venezuela, the Associated Press found that families around the world are already facing starvation, with young children the first to suffer and die. The COVID-19 crisis has disrupted a rare opportunity for Native American communities to address a lack of critical internet access by missing a deadline to obtain free broadband licenses from the government. The cutoff for tribes to apply for licenses from the Federal Communications Commission expires August 3rd, and the process entails submitting complex application surveys and maps. The FCC commissioner said only about 15% of eligible tribes have applied. The FCC says 628,000 tribal households lack access to standard broadband, a rate more than 4 times that of the general population. Policy Institute found nearly 1 in 5 reservation residents has no internet at home at all. Just 4 days after beginning a truncated coronavirus delayed season, Major League Baseball ran into a serious obstacle Monday with the postponement of scheduled games due to COVID-19 outbreaks among Miami Marlins players. The postponement of the games in Philadelphia and Miami was a potentially ominous development for MLB and other major professional sports leagues in the United States and Canada, hoping to forge ahead during the pandemic. Court proceedings for a trial in Mexico that could expose years of alleged corruption by current and former leaders is set to proceed Tuesday. An official from Mexico's judicial authority say an initial court hearing into corruption charges against Emilia Lozoya, the former boss of a Mexican state oil firm, Petróleos Mexicanos, is scheduled for 9 a.m. Tuesday. Lozoya, who was chief executive of the firm known as Pemex from 2012 to 2016 under Mexico's former president, Enrique Peña Nieto, faces accusations ranging from accepting bribes to money laundering. And Mexican prosecutors contend that before he became the boss, Lozoya, among other things, solicited and obtained funds from a Brazilian company and funneled cash into the 2012 presidential election campaign of Peña Nieto. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. Today is Tuesday, July 28th. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. This week and next, I'll be filling in for James Butte. We have a great show for you lined up, so do not reduce the volume. Here are the stories we are covering. Leading Tanzanian opposition figure Tundu Lissu returns home after 3 years in exile.
First of all, we thank God for bringing him back alive. As you can imagine, he was shot 16 times in his body, but he has arrived after 3 years of being away in treatment. And Dar es Salaam people, they have showed so much love with him.
That was John Rema, a spokesperson for Tanzanian opposition party Chadema. Plus, West African leaders make a decision on Mali's political crisis. Sudan's government responds to a wave of killings in Darfur. Boda Boda motorcycle taxis are back on the streets of Kampala. Kenya's government orders bars to close, and Zambia's government suspends the mayor of Lusaka.
The local government act provides and grants power to the minister of local government to suspend a councillor, a mayor, or a chairperson.
That was Dr. Bishop Chomba, permanent secretary of Zambia's Ministry of Local Government, defending the suspension of Lusaka's mayor. All these stories are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Our top story today, Tanzanian opposition leader and potential presidential candidate Tundu Lissu arrived home Monday from Belgium. He had gone into exile for medical treatment after being shot 3 years ago by unknown gunmen. Thousands of supporters from his party Chadema greeted the 52-year-old at the airport in Dar es Salaam. A fierce critic of President John Magufuli's government, Lissu was shot 16 times in an attack by unknown gunmen in September 2017. At the time, Magufuli condemned the shooting and ordered security forces to investigate, but no one has been arrested. Lissu, a former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, was arrested 8 times in the year leading up to the attack, including 2 weeks before being shot. He was charged with incitement, among other alleged offenses. Lissu is currently vice chairman of Chadema and plans to vie for the presidency in October's general elections if he wins his party primary. For more, my colleague Peter Clotti spoke to John Rema, Chadema's director of communications, foreign affairs, and protocols. Rema spoke from the crowd that marched Monday with Lissu through Dar es Salaam.
First of all, we thank God for bringing him back alive. As you can imagine, he was shot 16 times in his body, but he has arrived after 3 years of being away in treatment, first in Kenya and then in Belgium, and now he's back to the country. And Dar es Salaam people, they have showed so much love with him. We are marching since that time till now. This is the fourth hour we are still on the road to the office.
What is the significance of the arrival of Tundu Lissu to your party? How significant is he?
This is election year. And as you know, Tundu Lissu is among the presidential aspirants in our party. We are expecting to hold our national convention on 4th of August to nominate a presidential candidate. And Lissu is one among them. So the significance of him is, first, he's the miracle walking, but secondly, he's one of the aspirants for the presidential candidate. And we are expecting that the National Convention, they can hear the voices of these people.
What role do you think he can play in leading Chadema to challenge President Magufuli in the upcoming October elections?
He's a very important person because at the moment we need someone who can talk about the rule of law, human rights, and the freedom of people. And in our country for the last 5 years, people have been suppressed, parliament have been suppressed, no one who can speak. So we need someone who can assure us our freedom back, that he or she will respect the freedom of our people. He or she can respect the rule of law and our constitution. As long as our constitution is bad, but at least you need someone who can respect it.
People have talked about an alliance which will give the opposition a significant chance to win election because of the dominance of the CCM. Is your party talking to any political party to form an alliance ahead of the elections?
We are very open and we have started a negotiation and on coalition building with some of the opposition political parties, including ACT Wazalendo, and even their presidential candidate, the former Minister of Foreign Affairs. He has made a public statement that if Chadema will make it Tundu Lissu to be a presidential candidate, then he will support him.
Some CCM members are saying the arrival of Tundu Lissu will not be enough to serve as a significant boost for your chances of wrestling power from John Magufuli, because the president has shown and his record has shown that he's capable of defeating you soundly come October. What is your response to that?
Today, I think those people who are saying that, they have seen by their naked eyes that the public is tired and they are ready. They are ready for the coming election, and the CCM, I'm sure, today they have got a message that the public, they thought these people are quiet because they fear. But today they have showed that they don't have any fear, and that's why we are saying that the arrival of Tundu Lissu has boosted the opposition to another level and has showed that the nation is ready for the coming election.
That was John Mrema of Tanzania opposition party Chadema speaking to my colleague Peter Cloti. West African regional body ECOWAS on Monday proposed a four-point plan to resolve Mali's political crisis that it says should be implemented within 10 days. The West African leaders recommended sanctions against anyone standing in the way. Tens of thousands of protesters have answered calls from the M5 opposition movement to take to the streets in recent months, demanding President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta resign. The demonstrations were caused by contested elections of lawmakers, persistent insecurity, and perceived government corruption and incompetence. The unrest turned into a full-blown crisis this month after police killed some protesters. At least 14 people have died, according to the United Nations. For more, I spoke to VOA's Madibo Dembele in Bamako. He began by explaining the details of ECOWAS's decision.
According to the president of Niger, Issoufou Mahamadou, they agreed that the 31 lawmakers that the election has been disputed, so the resignation immediate of those folks. Because remember, the election of some lawmakers has created protests and riots across the country. And those lawmakers are 31. And also they ask about a new reconfiguration of the Constitutional Court of Mali and according to the rule of law of Mali, and the creation of a new government or national government with the participation of the opposition and also the civil society, and the creation of an independent commission which will be investigating about the crime and violence that was committed during the protests. Those are mainly the main recommendation that was made today. And also, one of the key things that we can add on these things is the new implementation, or to speed up the implementation of the Algeria peace deal between Mali and the rebel groups.
And how has Mali's government responded?
Right now, we didn't see any official communique from the government, but we know it was present during that video conference today between ECOWAS leaders.
What about supporters of the government?
I talked at the same time to some members also of the CFR, which is like the Convention for Republican Forces, which is an entity supporting the government. Those people are also backing what the ECOWAS leader just said today, even though the Malian government has not issued yet a press release or a communique.
And what about the M5, the opposition who has been leading these protests?
I just got a phone interview with a M5 leader. His name is Mamari Biton Koulibaly. And they say they disagree entirely with all the things that the ECOWAS leader just said. And they're going to maintain their request, which is the resignation of the president of Mali.
So what will happen next?
In the phone interview that I got with the M5 leaders, they are just waiting the celebration of the Muslim holiday, which is on July 31st. And according to him, on August 3rd, they're going to launch again, or they're going to maximize the civil disobedience across the nations.
That was my VOA colleague, Modibo Dembele, who has been covering Mali's political crisis from the ground in Bamako. VOA will keep a close eye on that story. Sudanese in the western Darfur region on Monday buried their dead from the latest bout of violence after more than 60 people were killed over the past 2 days. Around 20 more people were also killed last week in South Darfur, with other attacks taking place elsewhere in recent weeks. The cause of the attacks are unclear, but Darfur has long been plagued by violence between indigenous groups and Arab militia, who at times have been backed by Sudan's military, including the Rapid Support Forces, which is led by one of Sudan's leading politicians. Sudan's government in Khartoum is deploying more security forces to Darfur. For more on the government's response to the violence, I spoke to journalist Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
They've been promising that they are going to restore peace and stability in that region by sending some prosecutors to go and investigate those incidences. And they are mentioning that if any individual, even if among rapid support forces or among the police or among the Sudan armed forces, found guilty of committing such atrocities, those individuals might face the justice or might face the law.
Now, is there any evidence that the attackers are linked to Sudanese government forces, whether the army or the rapid support forces?
In some attacks of previous weeks that happened, like in near Tete town in central Darfur and in Khartoum and Kapkabia in northern Darfur, yes, some locals were pointing fingers, accusing some members of the rapid support forces of individually carrying out these atrocities against the locals due to their personal, you know, reasons and all. But up to this moment, the Sudanese government, the Sudanese transitional government, has not come up clearly that, yes, there are members of rapid support forces involved in these atrocities or these attacks.
How else has Sudan's government been responding to this crisis?
The central government in Khartoum in previous weeks seems to be reluctant about the situation in Darfur. They seems to be busy with the peace talks in Juba and other issues related to the establishment of the transitional government, appointing governors and other things like that. But in late weeks, after the incident of Central Darfur, government delegation headed by the member of the Sudan Sovereign Council, they met with the protesters demanding protection of agricultural season and all. And they vowed to take into consideration all the demands. Last week, there is another delegation also headed by another member of Sovereign Council to northern Darfur in Al-Fashir to go and visit the areas such as Khartoum and Kapkabia and Fatah Borno, where a series of attacks also happened on civilians. Many of them were killed and others injured, by the same suspected militia. So we can say, yes, the government has taken steps in recent days to try to understand the situation and try to also restore peace and calm among the local residents in Darfur region.
Last of all, there is a joint African Union-United Nations peacekeeping force in Darfur. What are they doing?
The joint UN and African Union troops that has been in Darfur region, the UN Security Council has taken a resolution to withdraw the mission, or to actually close the mission in Darfur. Up to December this year, the whole mission will be closed. I talked with the spokesperson for UNAMID a few months ago. He actually told me, yes, they have reduced from 17,000 troops to about 4,000 troops, and majority of them are actually police, which are basically kept around the IDP camps to just give very slight protection to the IDPs and all. So many towns, many villages in many parts of Darfur remain actually fragile, remain without protection.
That was journalist Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan. After 4 months of lockdown in Uganda, motorcycles commonly known as bodabodas have resumed public transport. However, new rules to curb the spread of COVID-19 are pitting both drivers and passengers against authorities. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
For 4 months since Uganda instituted a lockdown to curb the spread of COVID-19, motorcyclists known as bodabodas were banned from carrying passengers, though they were still allowed to carry luggage. On Monday, following a presidential directive, motorcyclists were allowed to give rides again. Semakula Anthony says he has been struggling to survive during the lockdown since carrying luggage is not as lucrative as carrying passengers. To carry passengers, each motorcyclist is required to wear a mask. They are also expected to take riders' temperatures and to keep a register of passengers and their phone numbers so authorities can trace them if necessary. Anthony says he can't afford a thermometer and he thinks the register is pointless. He says all the regulations put in place need money. How do you ask a bodaboda guy to carry a temperature gun, yet he's carrying one person? He says, then again, you ask me to have a records book. And that book, even if I write that I took so-and-so, yet this disease does not manifest the next day, that so-and-so was the rider, how does it help? He says, this is just to fail us. To beat the traffic jam in Kampala and get anywhere in time, many passengers prefer using the motorcycles over cars. But Benjamin Chisache says he's not comfortable sharing his personal details with people whom President Yoweri Museveni has on several occasions indicated are used to commit crime in the country.
Because I never know the person I'm traveling with or who is taking me to a particular place. The taxis were released and they're allowed to carry half their capacity, but we've never been asked to give them our details and we don't know the people you're sharing the taxi with. So it doesn't make sense for me to share my details with the border guy.
However, Ugandan police say the bodabodas will not be allowed to operate unless they follow the rules. Police spokesperson Freddy Nanga said failure to do so will trigger an investigation. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Kenya's Ministry of Health says the number of mental health cases, such as depression, have jumped dramatically during the COVID-19 pandemic. The country's mental health task force says 25% of outpatients and 40% of inpatients suffer from mental health issues, but more Kenyans are seeking help and speaking out, as Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Sheila Orono is going through her sixth therapy session and her first face-to-face this year. She's meeting her counselor to get help for a mental health problem that has grown worse in recent months.
In a phase where I just wanted to be alone, I don't want to talk to anyone, I don't want to do anything, but now I've gone back to my normal self. I can do something, I can even listen to a music. Like, the normal me has come back, I was heading to. But now with the therapy sessions and the need for me to come out and say that I'm suffering from bipolar, like a mental illness.
The Psychiatric Disability Organization in Nakuru County receives at least 4 patients a day suffering from different mental health issues. Zipporah Mumbi is one of the psychologists.
And just helping them to have psychological resilience, to realize that even during this moment, during the pandemic, where there are chances of heightened depression, that it doesn't mean that it's a season that will be there forever. But then during this process, they can have what you call psychological resilience for them to be able to cope and understand that they can still bounce back.
The World Health Organization defines mental health as a well-being in which an individual realizes his or her own ability and can cope with the normal stresses of life. 34-year-old Wangui Waweru developed COVID-19-like symptoms in March. After a few days, health workers dressed in protective gear picked her up. She says even though her test for the virus turned out negative, the treatment she got from some of her neighbors and community members affected her mentally.
You can see some 1, 2, 3 people understand you and talk to you or associates with you, but there are those who are so irritated, who don't believe that you can be healed.
This month, Kenya's Task Force on Mental Health, co-chaired by Frank Njenga, found that many Kenyans suffer mental illness without knowing it.
If you look at a family with five people, two parents and three children, at one point or another, one of them, at one point or another in their lives, will suffer from a mental illness of one sort or another. In other words, 20% of Kenyans, whether we like it or not, will at one point or another have a mental health need.
With a pandemic taking a toll on people's mental state, the Kenyan government is urging its citizens to seek help if they need it at this trying time. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nakuru, Kenya.
Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has directed all bars and alcohol joints to close after drinking establishments violated protocols set by the health ministry to contain COVID-19. Maureen Ojiambo joins us from Nairobi with more details. Hello, Maureen.
Thank you so much, Jason. And closure of bars and alcoholic joints was among the proposals President Uhuru Kenyatta received on Monday. This is a day after Kenya's Bar Owners Association protested the move to close their businesses. The entertainment joints were found to be among the leading cause of a recent surge in positive COVID-19 cases, and restaurants and other eateries have been banned from selling alcoholic drinks for 30 days. However, bars may have to wait further, as President Kenyatta did not give timeline of their reopening. It has been noted that since the country partially reopened its economy on 6th of July, COVID-19 positive cases went up by nearly 10,000, with more than 100 new deaths, an increase that is equivalent to 54% and 41% respectively. In his address also, Kenyatta said that it will be impossible to have another lockdown this soon and asked Kenyans to be responsible. He also pushed for reopening of higher learning institutions from September this year to January 2021. Back to you, Jason, in Washington.
Thank you, Maureen. That was journalist Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya. Zambia's National Ministry of Local Government on Monday suspended the mayor of the capital city, Lusaka, Miles Sampa, as well as Mayor Christopher Kangombe of Kitwe City in the Copperbelt province. Zambia's Minister of Local Government said the three-month suspensions will allow an audit of land allocation in the cities, but critics say the suspensions were actually due to jealousy. They say residents have praised the mayors for good performance, which angered the minister. In an interview with Peter Clotzi, the ministry's permanent secretary, Dr. Bishop Chomba, defended the suspensions.
We believe in this government that is led by President Dr. Edgar Chagwa Lungu that service delivery to the people of Zambia can only be delivered on a municipal level.
Now, the minister in suspending them said the suspensions was meant to deal with the ills that have been happening with the two councils with regard to land allocation. Specifically, was that referring to land allocation in these two major cities that some people are saying are politically motivated?
Now, the two local authorities, one in Lusaka and the other one in Kitwe, there was an altercation between the area member of parliament and also a local councillor where they had given land in a place they were not supposed to give. And people start to complain. Now, when you look at that critically, where does our minister come in? Under what we call the Local Government, you know, Act number 2 of 2018, under Section 56, provides and grants power to the Minister of Local Government to suspend a councillor, a mayor, or a chairperson. And when you go further, on Section 56 A and B provides for the appointment of a public officer to discharge all functions of the council. So the minister was right on the law to make sure that maybe there could be many more other local authorities that may be not giving land in the right way. So to pave way in order to clean up if there is any mess, therefore suspension for 90 days under Section 57 is imminent.
That was Dr. Bishop Chomba, permanent secretary in Zambia's National Ministry of Local Government, speaking to my VOA colleague, Peter Cloti. That's it for this Tuesday, July 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great day.